I'm Jonathan Mayhew from the Department of Spanish and Portuguese here at KU, and it's my honor, my great honor, to introduce Pierre Joris, who's a professor at SUNY Albany. He's a co-editor with Jerome Rothenberg of Poems for the Millennium, a truly landmark anthology of modern and postmodern poetry. He is a poet himself, an award-winning translator, whose versions of Paul Celan in particular have been very, very influential, especially on me. I remember carrying around my copy of Breath Turn or Atomwende in my bag for months at a time, and then repeating the experience later with Thread Sons. There are other translators of Celan into English, but it is Pierre who has really made his later, more difficult poetry available and accessible to those of us who cannot read it in German, and even to those who can read it in German. Pierre is also a longtime friend of Ken Irby, the distinguished poet whose life and work we are celebrating here today. So please join me in welcoming once again Pierre Joris.
Glasses. Water. Oh, we can stand here. Okay. It's funny, different feelings. I get up any place in the world and read poetry without batting an eyelid. I get up to read an essay and somehow there's a tremor in the stomach or something. I think that's what Derrida meant by the law of genre. Many thanks for inviting me. It really is a great honor. Also, honor is not what we're after. It is a great pleasure that we are after to be able to celebrate the man, poet, and a good friend of mine that I think of as one of the great contemporary voices in American poetry. This essay called Irby's Very Own or the Atlantic Turbine are really notes towards what will should become a larger, longer piece on Ken's work. Some first instantiation will be for the jacket interview. And as I'm saying this, I realize that when you start writing on Irby, it begins to look like an Irby letter, you know, with text in the middle and handwriting on the around the sides. Oh, mimesis. It would seem that Kenneth Irby and his work have forever been firmly located, not to say nailed down, in what Robert Duncan called Irbyland, i.e. the Great American Plains or Grasslands with Fort Scott and old Lawrence, Kansas as biohub. Thus, in his first letter to Ken, Robert Duncan sorts out them apples from them oranges by suggesting that you, Ken Irby, assigned yourself to grasslands. End of quote. While he, Robert Duncan, assigned himself the European in the form of the medieval via Kantorowicz, an acolyte of the Georgic circle. Duncan goes on to suggest, and I quote again, as in your grasslands you are searching rightly for what a poem is to be in an other poem, the winds, the grass, the plains will tell you, makers of a horizon you've known, I've only seen idly in passing, will tell you what I can't about beginning and end of form. This kind of is a pretty strange way of, you know, telling Ken, find it in the wind. It would also be easy enough to see in Irby's work an extension or continuation, or better, an expansion and a deepening of Olson's concerns for the American space, which does indeed come large on this continent and very large in Irbyland. One could thus read it even as the work on the West and the Great Plains that Olson had proposed at some point but didn't get to do himself, or couldn't do himself, really. A sympathetic critic, such as our common friend Eric Marcham, will make this link central and explicit. I'm quoting Olson. I'm quoting Marcham. The taste of Olson was pretty strong, suggesting that Irby's problem in the early poem was, quote, to shift usages of Olson's procedures, which in some places take over his own voice, end of quote, while the better poems make good use of the ellipses and discontinuities of Olson's gap-jumping lyric for a much calmer end, end of quote. These views, it is my argument here today, seem way too limiting to me, diminishing the achievement by proposing too pat a reading. And even in my title, I use the phrase that we'll recall at dawn. It is not so much for the jaundiced eye with which Dawn gazed at the turbine, which he saw nearly exclusively as commerce moving clockwise, but as a more cultural turbine moving counterclockwise, thus making it a countercultural turbine, and enriching the dust bowl soils of America. Or maybe this turbine is closer to Henry Adams's dynamo, so then one would have to read a near-Hegelian Aufhebung in Irby's version of the Virgin and the dynamo, wherever the Virgin may be. It may, in fact, appear strange that I, Europeano poet, who left the old continent to become poet in America, that is where I saw the energies achieve a poetic art unequaled in Europe post-World War II, would now want to link Irby back to what I left, or tried to leave, behind. If here, in the short time available, I'll speak to the Europe I feel traverses Irby's American land and mindscape, it would, of course, also be necessary to investigate two other centers of that turbine or dynamo, or great rotating wheel whose hub and heart may lie below, but certainly at the center of the Great Plains. As Irby put it, the great wheel of the plains turns underfoot God. Touch regularly China and Latin America, two constants in Irby's vast spiderweb of references. But let's have a look at Europe to some extent. And yes, anecdotally, the first time I laid eyes on Ken was when he stepped into my Deal Road house in Tooting Broadway in early 73, I think it was. But that was one of the more rare occasions that Ken spent time in Europe. He'd in fact come down from Denmark and was, if I'm not mistaken, on a trip that would get him to the southern countries of Europe and then back up to Scandinavia. So unlike Dawn, who spent years in England teaching and living there and kept returning to London, where, by the way, I have an image of Dawn standing in the same room where Ken and I stood in my house and arguing with Dawn, Dawn, strangely uninterested in my proposal to publish Gunslinger in French. I had been translating this. Dawn saying, French wouldn't understand it anyway. Fuck him. But that's another story. Ken's visit were shorter to Europe, but I think he was more sympathetic to all the wide range of European possibilities. The involvement was also deeper. During the last decade and a half, I had been thinking and writing primarily about concepts of of nomadic poetry and poetics, calling these at times archipelago poetics in homage of Edouard Glissant's peril investigations, and speaking of rhizomatic and dendritic processes. Interestingly enough, the terms archipelago and dendritic are, of course, also core to Irby's poetry and thinking. Ken could easily have found a space in the essay towards the nomad poetics, and we'll do so with this essay. One of the areas I investigated thus was that of of Maghrebian literature, particularly its Francophone wing, where on close reading I distinguished what I called ghostings on either formal or semantic levels by the other language, the spoken darijas or vernacular versions of Arabic. I propose to use this notion of ghostings to speak of what in Irby's poetry I perceive as a range of non-American presences, inscriptions, upwellings, conjurations, or whatever guise they take. Now, I want to quickly, just a bit like Ben there, I want to sketch out two aspects before I get to the other area. And the two aspects I want to sketch out are, I could call the exoteric and the esoteric. The first one, the exoteric, is the question of music. So if Olsen is memorably, in a memorable line, condemns the piped inversion of that mu-sick, he does, however, not seem to have much truck with music. I remember one reference to a contemporary composer, Pierre Boulez, but that was to Boulez's ideas, not his compositions. Even the presence of John Cage at Black Mountain doesn't seem to have jolted Olsen towards music much. Irby, on the other hand, though agreeing with Olsen about mu-sick, for example, the opening line of the poem Delius, talks of crap music on the radio, has a profound and ongoing relation to both classical European music and to jazz. The poem Delius could bear some close readings, which we got actually in half an hour ago, in the way it moves between the continents, linking the English composer to Florida, where Delius finds his footing, really, and his energy to write. So they're very, very interesting moves back and forth, setting that dynamo turbine into motion again. Even as in the poem, and I quote, "There would be a Delius of this northern Pacific redwood coast, with further marvelous geographical musical chairs being played, for example, Walt Whitman along the Loin into blackberry thickets towards the Reyes coast, agonizing before the third edition of Leaves of Grass along the North Atlantic shore, turning the conversation in the living room at Grèce to the high hills, wordless." So in there we have we go from the west coast to the east coast, and we go to a place that is split up here, which is where Delius lived at the end, which is a French village not too far from Paris called Grèce-sur-Loin, which appears here at one moment as Loin and then as Grèce. So you need to even to put those two together. Wonderful little puzzles there. In the living room at Grèce to the high hills, wordless. As even in this poem, so focused from the title on the musician Delius, the secret trails of the journeying are what need to be trodden, i.e. thought out. And I quote more, "This explains the secret trails from Fort Scott into the south, the secret ways Vanamee followed into Mexico with the sheep, the great circle back to California, to Florida, fixed between Jacksonville and St. Augustine by Delius and Conan Doyle, the deep trails Buchanan over Norway, foot tracks parading Jeffries down Nets and Fosse, corrects crossing and recrossing the natural mystery." And below and between the namings and the places, the dance of vowels and consonants of this work. So that now you hear the ghost of Delius, now the ghost of Ellington in his work, now the ghost of all the musicians that come through. And it is when you slow down and you reread and you forget the place names, or you read the place names as we did as kids, you know, when you move the semantic meaning of the words out of the way and just got to the sound of it by repetition and so on, and you'll get to a music in Ten's work that is quite amazingly rich and profound. The second, or esoteric counter, is just that. An interest in the Hermetic tradition. We know that Irby is extremely well read in those traditions from Freemasonry to Neoplatonism to Crowley and so on. The I Ching, we can mention any of the texts, will know them and they will somehow go into the work at some points. In fact, the three most knowledgeable men I met in my 45 years in America are three solid poets who are also friends and who are also the most knowledgeable in that sense people, and they are Garrett Lansing, Robert Kelly, and Kenneth Irby. Now, you know those classic man versus machine things, the human genius who plays the computer in chess? Well, I think that if we had the trio of Lansing, Kelly, and Irby, they would beat Google, the Google search engine, in terms of their knowledges. So his is a vision of the world deeply informed by this knowledge of the traditionary sciences that traverses and ghosts the poetry. It would take a full essay to approach this layer of the work, so I will not go there today except to bring up one aspect of this via a personal experience and relationship to the work. In the early 70s, I was living in South London, I already described the Deal Road place, and I too became very interested in this area and read widely in it. There was a great bookshop, long gone now, I believe, near the British Museum, I'm on the street right in front of the British Museum, where one could buy the books. And I spent at that moment a lot of time in the British Museum researching a book I published under a pseudonym called The Book of Demons, a coffee table book on demonology. I'm trying to make money as a writer, right? You know, 25, you think you could make it still on the money front. And in the British Museum, I got a hold. I asked him, I said, do you have John Dee's, you know, books by John Dee? And they brought him to me immediately, you know, and I was able to read John Dee in the original. And there were annotations in pencil in there. And I learned later that they were by Percy Shelley. Those were Shelley's own books, of copy of Dee. Had I known that, I would obviously have done something. I don't know what. on the other hand, a little sidestep there. I asked the same people at the BM to bring me the original French edition of the pornographic novels by Guillaume Apollinaire, and I was told I had to bring a letter from my bishop in Tooting to be allowed to do that. But the D book that had belonged to Shelley, they just kind of threw at you like that. It's, for me, the most interesting figure became Giordano Bruno. And I was deeply into Francis Yates' work on Bruno. And I had also found several French translations of Bruno's books. And just then, Ken Irby arrived at my house. And I shared immediately my enthusiasm with, on Bruno. And this, in fact, entered Ken's writing. So let me quote from page 372 of The Intent on, in the section Denmark. Walking around in the blue, in the blue and yellow morning off the Sweden ferry into London by the Mesa's edge, talking about Bruno, he must have been one of the most brilliant minds there ever was. Still in his overalls from work, the airline kind, I really dig his diagrams and study them a lot. But what do you do with them, old Pierre? I really think he is great. He's got them up like advertising displays all over the house. That question, what do you do with such knowledge, has always stayed with me and shows, I think, the way to look at how these materials enter and work on Irby's vision of the world. Knowledge as a transformatory action on our vision and understanding of the multiply world we live in. So thank you, Ken, for asking that question in deepest Tooting, back when I was but a tot. It helped a lot. I did do a little, I can tell you now. I translated some Bruno, some of the sonnets from The Triumph, the Beast. I read him deeply. I had him enter my work where needed, and in A Nomad Poetics, I included an essay that proposes Bruno as the patron saint of science, of translation. For it is Bruno who said in his lectures at Oxford that it is through translation that all sciences have their origin. Again, thanks for that, Ken. Here, an offering is a translation of a Bruno line that gives us the most modern poetics. Quote, poetry is not born from rules, or only most accidentally so. But rules are derived from poetry, and there are as many genuses and species of rules as there are genuses and species of true poetry. That is Bruno in the Heroic Führers in 1585, which is an amazing statement on poetry and poetics. Okay. As you say in your letters, onward. So let me get back to that un-American dynamo, turbine. There are in Irby's work, of course, immediately, all the literary sources that are not American and that are there. We know, for example, from his interview in Wood, that the first literary influence, or what gave him poetry in a way, was reading Rilke's Duino Elegies in the Leichmann Spender translation, found in Kansas City when he was in 8th or 9th grade. We also know of his continuous interest in Russian poetry and writing, especially in Osip Mandelstam and Boris Pasternak, as well as Bloch, but also, of course, you know, some French literature. His first book, The Roadrunner Poem, which is indeed a totally American poem, if ever there was one, is introduced by a quote from Rimbaud's Saison en Enfer, cited in French without accompanying English translation, which I think is a very lovely, strange mode there, you know, before the Roadrunner. Europe doesn't know the Roadrunners. We ain't got no Roadrunners, except in cartoons. Well, I found them, and I didn't know there were real things like that till I got here. In Jed Smith's And the Way, another long meditation on the American road, and as Mottram has it, quote, structured like an old Buick drive along the routes a trapper, mountain man, and guide took in the early 19th century into Oregon, the narrative drive is stopped short towards the very middle of the poem, with reflections on the formal nature of the poem of that poem itself, which bring in a European contemporary of Jedediah Smith, the German poet Friedrich Hölderlin. I quote, Hölderlin called the lyric the continuous metaphor for a feeling, the epic the metaphor of an intellectual point of view. This is the discontinuous dendritic narrative of a journey, metaphor of pasture, anabasis and return, pastoral in that sluicing, meaning the juice runs down over the head and puddles off the fingers. And this list of European writers coming in, ghosting the text, could go on ad infinitum. But let's look at another aspect in which America is ghosted by the non-native, namely the geography of the West, its landscapes. For example, in the poem Jesus, with its secret path that leads south, Irby links his Fort Scott landscape via a nomadic Jesus moving from the north to the south, quote, as if a tracer through the Ice Age intestinal dirt track, reaching down the plains again from Asia towards an absolutely other earthly paradise. And the poem then goes on, pungent southward in the silent age of America, 1952, not ripe for any second coming, only to scout if all the Mesopotamian, Siberian welfare trails were still reblazable under the shit. That would be American shit, needing to be turned into manure to fertilize the Dust Bowl scape, perhaps. And having other and older cultural materials come in will help in this process, hopefully speeding it up, or at least making the creation of an inhabitable dwelling, a hearth, possible. Here to reach back is long, space-wise to Mesopotamia and linking to Siberia, and time-wise from the Ice Age to what seems to be like a communist welfare present. The Jesus in there, in one moment, is feared to be a communist, steps off the train in Fort Scott. At first sight, this could still be read as Olsonian, i.e., as the jump back from present-day America to pre-Greek Near Eastern cultures and their roots in Pleistocene. This, by the way, this is core to Ken's work. If Olson decided that the only European landscape was dealing with or thought, you know, was pre-Aristotle and Plato, and then it all moved to America in the 20th century, leaving out a certain range of cultural background that we're involved in, that is exactly the space, in a way, that Ken very much moves through and uses and brings over into the work. But this is complicated, so this information is complicated by a range of other references, such as the figure of this weird motorcycle Hell's Angels, Jesus, as, quote, an Easter revolutionary, he must be a communist, end of quote, with the classical Christian fish, more ambiguously also readable as sexual, cunt or prick, as emblem, and that becomes, for Irby, the tarot card of the hitchhiker. Tarot cards are European medieval in origin, and even if another clin d'oeil to Olsen is also intended, there's a famous poem in which there is one of the great Arcana cards that come in an Olsen poem. They move us firmly into a specific Irby area, namely Hermetic lore and literature, as you know I began broaching a bit earlier on. One could extend such analysis and find examples throughout the oeuvre, but let's move on. I believe that one of the essential aspects of this doubleness, or better, as I hate to get stuck in a dialectical binary system, this multiplicity of layers has to do with Irby's comprehension of landscapes as not only natural, not in fact ever only natural, and one should here insert a full essay on what natural may or may not mean, something I'd love to do on another occasion, taking my clues from Spinoza, who I think would be very interesting to look at Kant's work and notions of natural, notions of immanence, and so on. This complicity is well set forth in a line by the geographer Edgar Anderson, quoted by Kant in place of a preface of Catalpa. Why not call it a preface? Why a place in place of? What is a place that stands in for another place? Those ghost things I was talking about would come in. Or is it a supplement, the pemmican we chew instead of the actual bison filet mignon? The poetic statement of explanation instead of the poem itself? My Derridaean proclivities could easily slip here into a long zigzag reflection that in turn could get me lost in Urbi land, like any number of those greenhorn conquistador explorers of old. I'll do my best to avoid this fate right now and stop. So in the preface to Catalpa, Anderson says it clearly. It is not only what we see, it is also what we see in it. So yes, it may be obvious, but bears restating. The landscape is also of the mind, or palimpsest of geography and mind, where the one ghosts the other, so that the leaves of the trees, Catalpa or other, rhyme, Duncan Eskley, with the leaves of the books read and or written there. Urbi himself is very clear about this. For example, in the introduction to Relation, when he writes, "But I am concerned here with the precise landscape wherever we are, here and now, as the spiritual landscape." This is a direct response to a landscape that both demands us and reveals us. Here one should also place a discussion of the relation of Urbi's pastoral to the European, and more specifically the British version thereof. But this has been done, I think, in a number of essays over time, and there is no reason to repeat this here. I do, however, want to locate the movement through the, any landscape, more specifically, as I perceive a ghosting, perhaps unconscious, with a range of other literary events. What I call the nomadic is, of course, very present in Urbi's work, in, for example, the definition of American poetry as narrative of a journey, a narrative that I think does not easily fit under the Hölderlinian definitions that we quoted above, which give precedent to the metaphor. Thus, a strange doubleness in which I would, in fact, read an opposition in the juxtaposition of these two lines, when after the near-Deleuzian rhizomatic definition of the work as the, quote, discontinuous dendritic narrative of a journey, end of quote, the next line brings it all back home, Europe, a certain fixity, by redefining this definition as being a metaphor of pasture, anabasis, and return. Three loaded words here. One, pasture, which in this context sounds closer to the pastoral as defined by the likes of Empson, as a metaphor for an other state, rather than as Urbi's own description of the pastoral as a daily concern with the precise landscape of wherever we are, both as physical and as spiritual landscapes. Maybe my distrust of the word here comes from its association with, two, the word anabasis, where, and this may be personal to my own Euro basis, I cannot but hear the title of Saint-Jean Perse's poem Anabase, not surprisingly translated into English by T.S. Eliot, a poem that, despite its title and travel components, is a static colonial venture. Of course, the word alone in Urbi's line could also dendritically or rhizomatically spiral out to the moth Anabasis, a genus of snout moth from the Physitinae subfamily, or maybe closer to home, the plant Anabasis, a genus of desert shrubs in the Amaranthaceae family. And finally, word three, return, which has its own problems when it comes to nomadic spaces. So, I am partial to the nomadic definition of the poem as a discontinuous dendritic narrative of a journey. And rather than return the journey to a fixed European pastoral space, breathtaking only due to the narrowness of it, of its hedged-in beds that keeps you from breathing, in that sense, I want to link it to another ghosting. Urbi's journeying and the inscription of that journey into his poems is, for example, for me quite different from Kerouac's On the Road. That mad rush from one side of the continent to the other, coast to coast, with stopovers only when too exhausted to keep driving. Urbi's progress is via a range of fixes, he calls them, bearings taken, requesting stages, stopovers, rests, which I would assimilate to the physical and spiritual stops, or the mawqifs, as they are known in the Sufi journey, in the nomadic progress. The stops, mawqifs are also the stops in the circumambulation of the Kaaba. They are what, you know, the spiritual Sufi master does. It comes out of the nomadic crossing and traveling. And it's a bit like the stations of the cross. You know, if you want to take that to Christian origin, you'd find it there. The discontinuity, the dendritic nature of the journey is accepted and made use of. Stages for reflection, for companionship, for writing, for cooking, eating, drinking, and fucking. I do, however, disagree with Eric Mottram's assessment that with, quote, the self-asserted through a world of revelatory signs, Irby moves steadily towards the transcendental, a mysticism of land and mobility, of that sense of Americans being necessarily shaped by the violence of the continent. End of quote. I would, in fact, maintain, proof has to be withheld until that Spinoza essay is done, that the journey is towards an ever deeper immanence, that the life teachings of the movements through America are the exact experiences that show how the physical and mental journeys are or become inseparable, are the same. Irby touches on this, for example, when he writes, "Lords of the light and air are immanences, not rulers." And if in the journey itself, in the speed of movement, there can be a giddiness that would point towards an other, with a capital O, beyond the horizon, some transcendental topos, as it is in the mawqif, the stopping, the rest, and the necessary tasks of that dailiness, that immanence roots itself again. There are four lines from an early work by Ken in The Flower of Having Passed Through Paradise in a Dream, which was the first book of his that I picked up in the late 60s, four lines that have stayed with me and that came back to mind or to hand very often over time. Here they are. The light lasts on out of history or memory, in the face and turn of head towards the sink, that endlessness of every day that is precisely eternity. Thank you all. Thank you, Ken. Happy birthday. Onward!